BlizzCast, your official Blizzard podcast.
Hello, and welcome to BlizzCast Episode 8. This is Bornak from the World of Warcraft community team. In today's Q&A session, we have some StarCraft 2 questions for Dustin Browder, some Diablo 3 questions with Jay Wilson, but up first, we have our World of Warcraft questions with Tom Chilton. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thanks. How you doing?
Doing pretty good. How about you?
Not too shabby.
Good, good. The first question today is from Sneaky Snakes on Wildhammer. Before Wrath of the Lich King came out, there was talk of aerial combat in Wintergrasp and in the game in general, with like some goblin anti-air shredders being put in the game. And Howling Fjord shows some footage of this as well. What happened with aerial combat, and do we still plan to put into the game?
Well, the aerial combat that we had in Wintergrasp, we just ended up feeling wasn't really polished enough for the final experience. You know, we gave it a shot with the vehicle technology that we had, but ultimately it was a little goofy that you could crash your airplane into the ground, nothing bad would really happen. And then also the kind of sense of flying really wasn't there enough. If you look at a lot of, you know, games that have done flight simulation, there's a lot of care that goes into giving you that sensation of flying by having the world tilt and stuff like that. So it feels a little bit less mechanical, feels a little bit more alive or more natural. So one of the things that we've kind of tasked ourselves with doing is figuring out how to polish that, how to improve on our vehicle physics. There's still a lot of vehicle physics tech that we want to get in that didn't make it into the first pass of Lich King. So, you know, we have to make some tough decisions sometimes about what we're going to go forward with and what just isn't working out well enough to meet our quality standards, and that was one of them. So it's definitely still on our list of things that we want to do. We have a lot of people here that are passionate about vehicle combat, passionate about making it more interesting, more fun by, you know, increasing the number of things we can do with it, and that would definitely include the possibility of aerial combat.
The other question from the same player was just if we had plans to add any additional ranks to Wintergrasp, the battle there, and to like expand on the system in general.
Well, the things we would have to think about as far as ranks on Wintergrasp go would be kind of how it ties into the gameplay as it's established right now. Really, the purpose of the ranks is to give you access to new kinds of vehicles, and in the absence of new kinds of vehicles to give you, then that's doesn't seem to really be something that we'd need to do. It wouldn't really add a whole lot of value. Would be that interesting if you ranked up, but there was really nothing new to get as a result of it. Then we also have to factor in the combat time. You know, how much time do you actually spend in the Wintergrasp scenario, and is it reasonable to expect a player to actually get to that higher rank? Do they have enough time to get to a higher rank and actually have time to enjoy the result of getting to that rank? So, since we've tried to really make sure that Wintergrasp is playable in a very reasonable, you know, period of time, the scenario doesn't tend to go a really long time, then it doesn't seem to me, at least, you know, not at first glance, that we'd really have room to add an additional rank for an additional vehicle, even if we were to actually create that vehicle and make it accessible. I don't think you'd have a whole lot of time to do much with it.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions we had today. Thanks for stopping by, Tom, and we'll roll on to the next questions.
Right on.
Welcome to the next Q&A portion of BlizzCast. We have our Diablo 3 game director, Jay Wilson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
So we got a couple Q&A questions for you today. The first one is from Dalex on US East. Will shrines be making a return to the World of Sanctuary in Diablo 3?
Well, there's some aspects of shrines that we liked. Experience shrines, I think, are the prime example everyone uses. They're fun because they drive the player forward. I think there's monster shrines are sometimes fun because, you know, they bring you out a rare that you didn't know, you know, weren't expecting and could come from any direction, and that's cool. But for the most part, the pure mechanic of shrines, a random power-up that just kind of appears in the world for no reason, we don't really want to bring that literally back. What we're going to try to do is integrate a lot of the best things of shrines into our quest and event system so that when you encounter a random quest or a random event that has a story context within the game, it either rewards you like a shrine would reward you, or something, you know, it's built into the actual gameplay of the quest. So while technically no, shrines are not coming back verbatim, we are trying to bring back kind of the best things of them in a different form.
Yeah, so you still have the randomness, spontaneity of things in the
exactly.
game.
And they're really there to kind of change up the gameplay and add a little bit of factor of randomness. But mm-hmm. we felt that very few of the shrines actually did that, accomplish mm-hmm. that goal.
Stamina shrine.
yeah, stamina shrine lets you run a long time. Skill shrine made you a little bit more powerful. Like, we feel like we can take the best of the shrines and put them within actual events that are a lot more fun and have a lot more gameplay to them.
All right, great. The next question is from David Nishbal in Fairfield, Connecticut. Will buildings and towns be enterable, like Atma's Bar was from Diablo II's second act?
There'll probably be some buildings. My guess is not too far off from how many were enterable in Diablo II. Most towns, we don't make all the buildings enterable. It's just a ton of art to create for very little reason. Most of the time, people tear through the towns at lightning speed, so they don't really have a strong desire to go into the individual buildings. Okay. But we do have some specialty buildings that I'm sure we'll go inside of throughout the course of the game.
Okay. The next question is from James on US West. Will there be a diverse selection of items that are viable for the end game, or will it follow the WoW type style where there's more like a one end all be all set for each class?
It's definitely diverse, and it's diverse on a lot of different fronts. When you think about Diablo II, all the different ways you can build your character, we've really expanded the ways that you can customize your character by adding in the rune system. Mm-hmm. So not only can you completely customize your skill set, much more so than you can in a game like most MMOs and a game like World of Warcraft. Because of that, the items that you want really are based upon the skill set that you've chosen or the type of build you're trying to create. And items are one of the things we're trying to do is focus them as even a greater element of defining your build. So really, it's just kind of up to the player. What kind of stats do they want on their character? But we're definitely not shooting for a, here's the barbarian armor and there's mm-hmm. a full set. And when you get the full set, you're done. Like, right. That's just not very Diablo. Mm-hmm. And it's not really the kind of gameplay we're going for. If anything, we'd like for the item set to be far more diverse than it was even in Diablo 2.
Always something to collect, right?
Exactly. Always a new build to try out.
Right, exactly. The last question we have today is from Jeff Wichtowski. And have you settled on a particular color scheme for item drops?
We've kind of gone round and round on color scheme. I know with World of Warcraft, when they decided for like a color scheme to fit quality, they were taking that from Diablo 2 and other MMOs, but mm-hmm. they chose a color set that they felt was easier to read. We actually tried to emulate that for a while. I think actually either our announcement build or maybe our BlizzCon build mm-hmm. was actually using a color scheme very similar to World of Warcraft. And we generally found we just didn't like it because it didn't feel Diablo. Something as, mm-hmm. as simple as detail as that, it just didn't feel like Diablo anymore. So our color scheme is pretty solid right now, and it follows very closely to the Diablo 2 color scheme. We slightly shifted some of the hues just to help, especially with color blindness, to try and mm-hmm. get some of the more problematic combinations. And we took out, for example, uniques were gold. We've changed their color. I think we did purple, which is a bit of a nod to World of Warcraft. But the problem was gold and yellow were really close.
Right.
Even though the gold lettering was unique and everything, it was often very difficult to tell the two apart. So we just did that not to get away from Diablo, but to try and fix that kind of readability issue. But what we found is that when we go too far away from Diablo, it doesn't feel right. So right now we're, magic items are blue, rare items are yellow, unique items, like I said, I think they're purple. I'm operating off memory here. but they might be different actually, because I think we use purple for something else, for an item type we haven't announced yet. Mm-hmm. And then if we do set items, they'll be green. We haven't made a call on set items yet.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions we have for today. Thanks for coming in, Jay.
My pleasure.
For the next segment, we have some StarCraft II questions, and our lead game designer, Dustin Browder, has come back to help answer them. Welcome back, Dustin.
Hey, everybody.
The first question is from Norfindel on Battle.net. Can you give us some insight into the current air model? Like, what are the roles of the air units, and what do you see working really well in game?
Well, obviously, each of the races behaves very differently with how they use their air units. The Zerg, obviously, their Mutalisk is still a very powerful part of the Zerg Air Force and is still used for a lot of fast raiding, a lot of sudden attacks from different directions to try to throw the enemy off balance. And, of course, in mass, in the endgame, you can obviously use Mutas for these sort of massed air assaults. The other races behave a little bit differently. The Terrans, with their Banshee, is a very, very powerful anti-ground unit. It can even sometimes just power right through base defenses, which really the Wraith couldn't have handled in the original game. So you see a lot of need for all the races to have some very powerful anti-air weapons of their own in order to deal with these kinds of threats. A similar threat on the Protoss side is the Void Ray, who has a very powerful beam that can really do a lot of damage to enemy buildings. So you see that there's very heavy hitters in the air in StarCraft II that really require you to get out there and use some of these more dedicated anti-air units like the Corruptor, like the Phoenix, to really fend off these powerful sort of air threats. It really is, obviously, you know, there's some similarities players will see from the original game. At the same time, you know, these really powerful hitters really do make a pretty big difference. You also see some new authority for some of the bigger units in the game. Certainly, the carriers have much longer range than they've ever had before. That makes them a very powerful threat from the air in the endgame. We should probably see more carriers used in higher level games, but obviously we'll see how that goes when we get into the beta. And of course, the Battlecruiser has three different options in terms of how he wants to sort of improve his Battlecruiser, whether he wants to buy a Yamato weapon for his Battlecruiser, whether the player wants to buy, you know, a shield for his cruiser. There's sort of different choices for the Terran player for the Battlecruiser, which again adds to the authority of these bigger endgame units, which makes them a little bit more practical in different matchups. Where previously, you know, you might see Battlecruisers in only certain matchups in StarCraft. Now in StarCraft II, you'll probably see them in more matchups sort of across the board.
Okay. Next question is from Ultima's X on Battle.net. I noticed that in the Protoss demo, the Protoss buildings, when warped in, had their surfaces like visibly warped in, like in the original StarCraft. It seems, however, in recent builds and footage, Protoss buildings just appear after the building animation, but the units still have the surfaces visible when warping in. So basically, it sounds like he's seeing some difference in the animations here. And can you tell how the animations are planned to work for the Protoss structures?
Sure. So I talked to Samwise just before coming here, our art director, and asked him about this, and he doesn't remember making any changes throughout the process to how the Protoss are supposed to be working. So it's possible either in some of the builds we put out or in some of the footage we've been put out, we may have had some errors, we may have had some bugs. I'm not exactly sure what people are seeing, but I can certainly speak to what the intention is and what the intention will be. The building will obviously have a warp-in state, just as it did in the original StarCraft, sort of a building state where there's sort of a big ball of energy and you can sort of see the building warping in, but it's not obviously clear what the building is going to be yet. And then as we get to the very final phases of the building warping in, you'll see an outline of the building sort of shimmering, sort of fading in as the building is teleported from its location on another world to this battlefield. And then finally the building will sort of harden and you see the gold, you know, shape, or in the case of Dark Templar buildings, you'll see sort of the you know, the more blue platinum shape of the building sort of form into place. So it should look at a basic level very similar to the way we warped in buildings in the original StarCraft, but obviously with our upgraded graphics engine, with the new 3D stuff, it should look a whole lot better.
Yeah, a lot more detail.
Yeah.
He had another question. He noticed that the Terran buildings, like, they smoke instead of just catching on fire. He knows it's a bit early, and he's just wondering if Zerg buildings will still bleed after taking damage.
I certainly hope so. We haven't obviously gotten to that stage where we're doing a lot of that work yet. A lot of the stuff people are seeing in-game right now, I know we're showing a lot of materials, and I know people are looking at it saying that this looks really good. It must be close to final. That's certainly not how the art team feels about it, right? And they've been going over and hitting individual units as we go forward, individual races. And the Zerg, in terms of their buildings and even their units, are still the furthest behind in that respect. So there's still a lot more work to go in on the Zerg. I know, for instance, that the Hatchery, the Lair, and the Hive are all going to go under massive revisions here in the next couple of weeks as we really punch up the art to represent those really iconic, critical, central buildings to a Zerg base. So there's still a lot of work to go into it, and certainly bleeding buildings would feel very Zergly, very appropriate for the race, and it's something we'd love to do.
All right. Well, that wraps up the StarCraft II questions. Thanks for coming in today, Dustin.
All right. Thanks, guys.
BlizzCast, your official Blizzard podcast.
Welcome to BlizzCast 8. My name is Bashyak, your Diablo 3 community manager. With me today is Julian Love, lead technical artist.
Hello.
And Mike Nicholson, our UI guy, or he's a senior artist on Diablo 3.
Hi there.
Start out with Julian. Some people might know you from WWI and BlizzCon. You were up on stage giving some presentations. For those who don't know you personally, what do you do on Diablo 3?
Well, I do a lot of things. I'll try to cover them briefly. So I run the technical art department, and the kinds of things that we do there are we build a lot of custom art tools to make production go a lot easier. And we also rig characters, which is a way of sort of making them puppetable so the animators can define how they're going to move. And probably the biggest visual contribution that we make is through special effects, breakables, and lighting.
Very cool. And Mike Nicholson, who is a new face and voice to those following Diablo 3, what do you do on the team?
I'm a senior artist, and I am in charge of all the interface.
So UI and...
Yes, also known as the UI guy.
UI guy. Very cool. So, Mike, actually, I wanted to touch on something that you did in the past. I was at your office a few weeks ago and found out that you were lead designer and lead art on a game that was near and dear to me, which was called Sanitarium. So, without going into it too much, that was a point-and-click adventure game. So, how did you get from that to working here at Blizzard?
I'm glad you liked it. I'm proud of that game. The thing was, when we did Sanitarium, unfortunately, even though it was well-received, everybody who played it liked it, not that many people played it. I mean, eventually right. did. We got there kind of like as the party was going out.
For point-and-click adventures?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you kind of take a look around and go, well, I guess I need to get back into art, you know. And,
right.
Came out to California and started doing 3D environments, and then kind of worked my way all the way back up to interface, where I'm back to doing 2D art again. So
very cool. Julian, back to you. One of the major FX systems is the death system, which kind of goes over how monsters die, which is the cooler parts of the game. And we've seen a little bit of that before at WWI and BlizzCon. But what is the system? Can you explain it to those listening, and what does it do in the game?
Something pretty close to my own heart there was, I really recognized that monsters really live to die in Diablo. You really don't have a lot of time to express their personality, and you don't have a lot of time to try to make your experience with monsters meaningful. Most of what you're doing is killing them. So one of the things I was really interested in doing was making as many different ways for monsters to die as possible. And so that was kind of the goal. And I think we're up to something like 35 ways for any given monster to bite it.
Wow.
At this point. But the basic theory is to really extend on the idea that Diablo 2 started with, which was that you would hit monsters and you would see the damage that you did to them reflected on them. And we said, well, let's take that further. You know, monsters could burn to death when you hit them with a fiery sword. And then we added the idea of crits, and you know, monsters could explode across the screen, and then it just kind of went from there. But that's essentially the idea.
Very cool. And a lot of the effects that you make factor into the abilities that the characters are using, so fire and arcane and all that stuff. But there's in the world of Diablo, there's very specific magic types that exist. It's not. It is actually a pretty broad spectrum, but is there any limitation there to what you can do with different, you know, arcane and fire and different damage types?
Yeah, in fact, that's a common input that I'll receive is, hey, this guy's a fiery this or whatever, but can we make that fire look green? And then that's where the sort of the designer in me has to, you know, kind of come out and say, well, wait a minute, you know, if we make fire green all of a sudden, it's a bit of a miscommunication in terms of the gameplay. And so there's a bit of constraint there in that at one point I'm trying to make things look as epic as they can, but at the same time, they have to be really clear to the player and so that they're not confused that, you know, green fire might mean poison. And then there's the other part of it, which is, it's really easy in my department to make a big mess. We can just, you know, clobber the screen with so many effects that you just can't see the game anymore. So those are the two constraints that we really work with most.
Right. Back to Mike. Since people saw the game at BlizzCon. They got to play it at BlizzCon, which was exciting for everybody. The interface in the UI has actually changed pretty dramatically even since then. It's been an iterative process since the conception of the game, really. But so for those that even didn't see it at BlizzCon, or for those that did, what are the changes that have come about since then?
Well, you know, one of the biggest things involved in Diablo is our items, right? And we've experimented with a few things, and one of the big things that everyone liked from Diablo, you know, as an entity, were the large objects, right? And while it was more efficient to go with a WoW style with a one-size-fits-all icon, which is what most people have seen, we really wanted to see what we could do. And so we went back and reevaluated the system, and we've decided to split it into large and small objects. And then that brings up the question, okay, but does that mean Tetris inventory, you know, all over again? And a lot of people are opposed to that. Some people like it, some people don't. So what we did is we ended up tabbing the inventory. So now you have your large items, and then you have a tab for your small items, and there's a third tab for quest items. That way all the items can coexist nicely with each other without the frustration, which was, you know, one of the complaints about the old system is the frustration in trying to fit everything into your pack.
And are we still going to see the bag system coming back, the expandable with the bags, or is it a set inventory size for each tab?
Current design right now is to have bags. You'll get bags and they will expand, you know, kind of like in WoW, except you're not going to open up separate windows. You'll start off with your inventory with, say, you know, 8 slots, right?
Right.
And then you'll get a new bag and that has 10, so 2 more slots will open up within that tab, but you'll never have multiple tabs. Like, you won't have 2 or 3 large tabs.
Right, right. Is that working out pretty well so far? It's been in testing for a while?
Yeah, most people seem to really like it. I mean, the feedback's been pretty good. I personally love it because it lets you do both. It lets you have the large icons, but it eliminates the frustration that people voiced about having, you know, different sized items within your inventory.
Right, and you can really see the artwork as it is now with the larger icons.
Oh yeah, 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 very much so.
Very cool. Okay. On kind of iterative processes, a lot of people at BlizzCon saw the skill icons, and there's been some talk in the community. The skill icons are definitely a departure from what we saw in Diablo 2,
right,
which were like these gold runes, almost, I guess. So what was the decision there to make a change to the skill icons and do, you know, colorful skill icons?
I am unabashedly a fan of WoW.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'll probably catch flack, you know, oh, you're making it look like WoW, oh no. But I love them. I love the WoW icons. And, you know, what we're trying to do is see, okay, what works about the WoW icons? You know, they're illustrative. Is there a way to maybe try to find a way to bridge the gap? You know, what worked about the more symbolic D2 icons, mm-hmm, and, you know, what works with the WoW icons, and trying to find a way to put the two together. And that's really what I'm trying to do, is to try to make them more symbolic, so they're not necessarily little murals, but they are painterly, you know, and so they are colorful, because you're going to have a lot more of them, you know, than right, you would at D2. So you have, you know, the hop art at the bottom. You want that to look colorful enough that it's interesting, but not to the point where it's an eyesore. And quite honestly, you know, I've made many iterations on the icons, and there's still many to come. And it ends up being a balancing act. You know, I test them out, see what they look like next to each other, you know, and if they're too colorful, tone it down, you know.
Right. One of the things that I like about them is, even without looking at your hotbar, you can kind of see, oh, this one looks blue and cold. It's probably an ice spell of some type. So without even mousing over it to see what it is, I can tell it, you know, it's at least of a specific magic or damage type or skill use or something like that.
Well, you know, probably one of the best experiences I've had working at Blizzard is the iterative process, which, you know, some artists don't like, but I personally love it because it lets me test stuff out. For a while I was trying out, okay, let's do color theory. Okay, so all the berserker skills will be this tone, and all the battle master will be this tone. And it's, you know, on paper it looked good, sounded good. It's okay, it's a nice theory. But then what we found is when you put them in the hotbar, you know, if you went down a certain tree, now everything's the same color at the bottom, and it's hard to tell them apart. You know, okay, I get a gold star for being clever,
right?
But then I lose points because it's not playable. So, you know, you go back and once again scrap it, reevaluate it. But I love that process.
Very cool. Back to Julian, the thousand pounder, which was debuted.
Julian's not a thousand pounder, but kind of rude.
Julian, the thousand pounder. At WWI, we unveiled the thousand pounder, and it had this really, you know, grand entrance where it was assembled out of the pieces of these sacrificed, I guess, virgins, if you will. Mm-hmm. It was such like a grand entrance for that monster. How did that come about?
I recognize it. It probably looks like it was really planned out and something that we worked on for a very long time. But it was one of those things where I think we originally wanted it to come busting through the wall there, mm-hmm. Because, you know, breakables being what they are, they're kind of the hot thing in the game. But I think there was some recognition that when you have a monster of that shape busting through a wall, it starts to look like a Kool-Aid commercial.
Right? Oh, yeah.
Which really undoes what we're trying to say with the thousand pounder.
Sure.
So, and it kind of stole some of the thunder of the Siegebreaker, who does that later on.
Right.
So, I think we very late in the game, not 3 weeks before we were scheduled to be done with that, we got some concept that looked like he was being beamed in Star Trek style. And my department just, you know, we did an emergency powwow, and we weren't really happy with that. And so we really asked ourselves, what do we really want to see here? And the hardest thing we could think to do was what we ended up doing. And we're all scared. Could we get it done? It was an enormous amount of work, and we were going to have to convince other teams to help us. We needed help from modeling. We needed help from animation. But there was just this really cool commitment from everybody that this was the best thing to do. And we were going to put a lot of overtime, and we just crammed on it in 2 weeks, and that's what popped out.
Very cool. Is that something we'll see in the final game, you think?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think there's been a lot of offshoot ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Like every other monster in the game, where applicable, we ended up building a skeletal structure into him, and even a muscular set and things like that you see, and those things are functional. So I wouldn't be surprised if you see skeletal and muscular thousand pounders running around, maybe half summoned and that sort of thing. There's a lot of leeway with it.
Very cool. And last but not least, you're both working on a system, which is the Barbarian's Fury system. So the Fury system, for those that don't know, the Barbarian uses it's sort of a reverse mana system, as it's not using mana as it uses abilities, but it builds up as he's fighting. So it kind of, he gets angry and he's, you know, chopping dudes down. He gets more and more fury to use for his abilities. But that's actually changed quite a bit. Can you guys go over how UI and FX are coming together to create that new fury system?
It's always an iterative process, right? And one of the problems that we had with one of the systems that we had tried out was it worked, but from a peripheral vision, you couldn't see what was going on. We wanted to be very clear and very bold about what was being done. So traditionally what happens is design will come to me and ask, you know, we'll talk about what are the goals we need to accomplish. And then I'll do some mock-ups, and then I take it over to Julian and hope that he can make those mock-ups look far better than my mock-ups.
and I think where we're at with it right now is the recognition that, spending your fury is what we really want you to be doing. Mm-hmm. We want you to see it as a commodity to spend in order to gain access to more power. And that wasn't really being communicated so clearly with the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to accomplish that goal of making it something that you can, you know when to spend, you know what you're spending, but you don't necessarily have to look directly at it to get there. So effects plays a little bit of a role there, but I think we're trying to not just put effects in there for effects' sake, but only do it when we think that it's going to help you really read and understand what's going on.
Yeah, because one of the problems was you would see the buildup more than what you had to spend. You know, like you would build your fury up, and then bong, then you'd have an amount you could spend, but everything was kind of sharing the same visual space, and you couldn't necessarily discern one from the other. And again, from an art standpoint, sure, you know, it worked, it was okay, but it wasn't conveying the gameplay, and you know, gameplay is king. You got to make sure that comes across in every way.
And can you describe for those listening what it currently looks like?
let's see, if I had to use a cruel comment, one that I made myself as I was making, it's the Fury traffic light, because it's, you know, it's three spheres stacked vertically. And no, we are not making them three different colors. As I was doing it, I'm like, great. You know, this pretty much well assures us that we are not doing different colors because it will indeed look like a traffic light. That's the gist of it. You know, you want, because when you're playing the game, you're centering, hopefully, you know, your vision is in the center of the screen. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be to your right and down below. So you need to see a very bright graphic that kind of flashes to let you know that even if you just flick your eyes down there, you'll see, I've got two or I've got three of, you know, whatever that is to spend. And really that was the goal. And then hopefully, you know, Julian and his team will, you know, ramp it up so that, you know, we want it to catch your eye while you're doing it, mm-hmm. but not be a distraction.
Right, right. Sounds like a cool system. I'm looking forward to it. For those listening on iTunes or elsewhere, be sure to check out the BlizzCast website because we will have images and some art assets and stuff to check out for this interview. And that about wraps it up. I want to thank Julian and Mike for joining me here today.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And that about wraps it up for BlizzCast 8. I want to thank you very much for listening. This has been Bashiok, signing off.
BlizzCast, your official Blizzard podcast.